content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the December 3rd, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. This edition is entitled New York Stories, an archival issue. I'll read a poem by Elizabeth Bishop and a short story by John Updike. I'll begin today with a poem, At the Fish Houses, by Elizabeth Bishop. Although it is cold evening down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting, his net in the gloaming almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs and narrow, cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver, the heavy surface of the sea, swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque. But the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild, jagged rocks, is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy, iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, sit in the sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains, like dried blood, where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I have seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I sang him, A Mightier Fortress Is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear. The clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified, tall firs begin. Bluish, associating with their shadows, a million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I have seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn, And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. Next, I'll read a short story in the fiction section by John Updike. John Updike contributed to the magazine for more than five decades, and he died in 2009. The story I'll read was originally published in the January 21, 1956 edition of the New Yorker magazine. The story is titled Snowing in Greenwich Village by John Updike. The Maples had moved just the day before to West 13th Street, and that evening they had Rebecca Kuhn over, because now they were so close. A tall, always slightly smiling girl with an absent manner, she allowed Richard Maple to slip off her coat and scarf, even as she stood softly greeting Joan. Richard, moving with extra precision and grace because of the smoothness with which the business had been managed, though he and Joan had been married nearly 2 years, he was still so young-looking that people did not instinctively lay upon him hostly duties, and their reluctance worked in him a corresponding hesitancy, so that often it was his wife who poured the drinks while he sprawled on the sofa in the attitude of a favored and wholly delightful guest, entered the dark bedroom, entrusted the bed with Rebecca's clothes, and returned to the living room. How weightless her coat had seemed. Rebecca, seated beneath the lamp on the floor, one leg tucked under her, one arm up on the hide-a-bed that the previous tenants had not yet removed, was saying, "I had known her, you know, just for the day she taught me the job, but I said, okay. I was living in an awful place called a hotel for ladies. In the halls, they had typewriters you put a quarter in." Joan, straight-backed on a Hitchcock chair from her parents' home in Vermont, a damp handkerchief balled in her hand, turned to Richard and explains, "Before her apartment now, Becky lived with this girl and her boyfriend." "Yes, his name was Jock," Rebecca said. Rebecca asked, "You lived with him?" The arch composure of his tone was left over from the mood aroused in him by his successful and, in the dim bedroom, somewhat poignant, as if he were with great tact delivering a disappointing message, disposal of their guest coat. "Yes, and he insisted on having his name on the mailbox. He was terribly afraid of missing a letter. When my brother was in the Navy and came up to see me and saw on the mailbox," with three parallel movements of her fingers, she set the names beneath in a column, "Georgine Clyde, Rebecca Kuhn, Jacques Zimmerman. He told me I had always been such a nice girl. Jacques wouldn't even move out so my brother would have a place to sleep. He had to sleep on the floor." She lowered her lids and looked in her purse for a cigarette. "Isn't that wonderful?" Joan said, her smile broadening helplessly as she realized what an inane thing it had been to say. Her cold worried Richard. It had lasted 7 days without improving. Her face was pale, mottled pink and yellow. This accentuated the Modigliescu quality established by her long neck and oval blue eyes and her habit of sitting with her back straight, her head quizzically tilted, and her hands palms downward in her lap. Rebecca, too, was pale, but in the consistent way of a drawing, perhaps by a Da Vinci. The weight of her lids and a certain virtuosity about the mouth suggested it. "Who would like some sherry?" Richard asked in a deep voice from a standing position. "Well, we have some hard stuff if you'd rather," Joan said to Rebecca. From Richard's viewpoint, the remark, like those advertisements that from varying angles read differently, contained the quite legible declaration that this time he would have to mix the old fashions. "The sherry sounds fine," Rebecca said. She enunciated all of her words distinctly, but in a faint, thin voice that disclaimed for them any consequence. "I think too," said Joan. "Good," said Richard, and he took from the mantle of the $5 bottle of Tio Pepe that the second man on the Spanish sherry account had given him. So that all could share in the drama of it, he uncorked the bottle in the living room. He posingly poured out three glasses, half full, passed them around, and leaned against the mantle. The Maples had never before had a mantle, swirling the liquid as the agency's wine expert had told him to do, thus liberating the esters and the ethers until his wife said, as she always did, it being the standard toast in her parents' home, "Cheers, dears!" Rebecca continued the story of her first apartment. Jacques had never worked. Georgine never held a job more than 3 weeks. The three of them contributed to a kitty, to which all enjoyed equal access. Rebecca had a separate bedroom. Jacques and Georgine sometimes worked on comic strips. They pinned the bulk of their hopes on an adventure strip titled Spade Malone, Behind the Bamboo Curtain. One of their friends was a young socialist who never washed and always had money because his father owned half of the West Side. During the day, when the two girls were off working, Jacques flirted with a Finnish girl upstairs who kept dropping her mop onto the tiny balcony outside their window. "A real bombardier," Rebecca said. When Rebecca moved into a single apartment for herself and was all settled and happy, Georgine and Jacques offered to bring a mattress and sleep on her floor. Rebecca felt that the time had come for her to put her foot down. She said no. Later, Jacques married a girl other than Georgine. "Cashews, anybody?" Richard suggested. He had bought a can at the corner delicatessen expressly for this visit, though if Rebecca had not been coming, he would have bought something else there on some other excuse, just for the pleasure of buying his first thing at the store, where in the coming years he would purchase so much and become so well-known. "No, thank you," Rebecca said. Richard was so far from expecting refusal that out of momentum, he pressed them on her again, exclaiming, "Please, they're good for you." She took two and bit one in half. He offered the dish, a silver porringer given to the Maples as a wedding present, and until yesterday, for lack of space, never unpacked, to his wife, who took a greedy handful. She looked so pale that he asked, "How do you feel?" Not so much forgetting the presence of their guest as parading his concern, quite genuine, before her. "Fine," Joan said edgily, and perhaps she did. Though the Maples told some stories, how they had lived in a log cabin at the YMCA for the first 3 months of their married life, in a YMCA camp, how Bitsy Flanner, a friend of them all, was the only girl enrolled in the Bentham Divinity School, how Richard's advertising work brought him into contact with Yogi Berra, they did not regard themselves, that is, each other, as raconteurs, and Rebecca's slight voice dominated the talk. She had a gift for odd things. Her rich old cousin lived in a metal house, furnished with auditorium chairs. He was terribly afraid of fire. Right before the Depression, he had built an enormous boat to take himself and some friends to Polynesia. All his friends lost their money in the crash. He did not. He made money. He made money out of everything. But he couldn't go on the trip alone, so the boat was still waiting in Oyster Bay, a huge thing rising 30 feet out of the water. The cousin was a vegetarian. Rebecca had not eaten turkey for Thanksgiving until she was 13 years old because it was the family custom to go to the cousin's house on that holiday. The custom was dropped during the war when the children's synthetic heels made black marks all over his asbestos floor. Rebecca's family had not spoken to the cousin since. "Yes, what got me," Rebecca said, "was the way each new wave of vegetables would come in as if it were a different course." Richard poured the sherry round again, and because this made him the center of attention anyway, said, "Don't some vegetarians have turkeys molded out of crushed nuts for Thanksgiving?" After a stretch of silence, Joan said, "I don't know." Her voice, unused for 10 minutes, cracked on the last syllable. She cleared her throat, scraping Richard's heart. "What would they stuff them with?" Rebecca asked, dropping an ash into the saucer beside her. Beyond and beneath the windows, there arose a clatter. Joan reached the windows first, Richard next, and lastly, Rebecca, standing on tiptoe, elongating her neck. 6 mounted police, standing in their stirrups, were galloping 2 abreast down 13th Street. When the Maples' exclamations had subsided, Rebecca remarked, "Oh, they do it every night at this time. They seem awfully jolly for policemen." "Oh, and it's snowing," Joan cried. She was pathetic about snow. She loved it so much, and in these last years had seen so little. "On our first night here, our first real night." Forgetting herself, she put her arms around Richard and Rebecca, where another guest might have turned away or smiled too widely, too encouragingly, retained without modification her sweet, absent look, and studied, through the couple, the scene outdoors. The snow was not taking on the wet street. Only the hoods and tops of parked automobiles showed an accumulation. "I think I'd best go," Rebecca said. "Please don't," Joan said with an urgency Richard had not expected. Clearly she was very tired. Probably the new home, the change in the weather, the good sherry, the currents of affection between herself and her husband that were her sudden hug had renewed, and Rebecca's presence had become, in her mind, the inextricable elements of one enchanting moment. "Yes, I think I'll go, because you're so snuffly and peaked." "Can't you just stay for one more cigarette? Dick, pass the sherry around." "A teeny bit," Rebecca said, holding out her glass. "I guess I told you, Joan, about the boy I went out with who pretended to be a head waiter." Joan giggled expectantly. "No, honestly, you never did." She hooked her arm over the back of the chair and wound her hand through the slats like a child assuring herself that her bedtime has been postponed. "What did he do? He imitated head waiters?" "Yes, he was the kind of guy who, when we got out of a taxi and there's a grate giving out steam, crouches down," Rebecca lowered her head and lifted her arms, "and pretends he's the devil." The Maples laughed, less at the words themselves than at the way Rebecca had evoked the full situation by conveying in her understated imitation both her escort's flamboyant attitude and her own undemonstrative nature. They could see her standing by the taxi door, gazing with no expression as her escort bent lower and lower, seized by his own joke, his fingers writhing demonically as he felt horns spout through his scalp, flames lick his ankles, and his feet shrivel into scarlet hooves. Rebecca's gift, Richard realized, was not that of having odd things happen to her, but that of representing, through the implicit contrast with her own sane calm, all things touching her as odd. This evening, too, might appear grotesque in her retelling. "Six policemen on horses galloped by, and she cried, 'It's snowing,' and hugged him. He kept telling her how sick she was and filling us full of sherry." "What else did he do?" Joan asked. "At the first place we went to, it was a big nightclub on the roofs of somewhere. On the way out, he sat down and played the piano until a woman at a harp asked him to stop." Richard asked, "Was the woman playing the harp?" "Yes, she was strumming away." Rebecca made circular motions with her hands. "Well, did he play the tune she was playing? Did he accompany her?" Petulance, Richard realized without understanding why, had entered his tone. Clarifying the incident had become strangely important, as if his confused picture of it were the product of deliberate deceit. "No, he just sat down and played something else. I couldn't tell you what it was. He didn't play very well." "Is this really true?" Joan asked, egging her on. "And then at the next place we went to, we had to wait at the bar for a table. And I looked around, and he was walking among the tables, asking people if everything was all right." "Wasn't it awful?" asked Joan. "Yes. Later, he played the piano there, too. We were sort of the main attraction. Around midnight, he thought we ought to go out to Brooklyn to his sister's house. Here I was, exhausted. We got off the subway, two stops too early, under the Manhattan Bridge. It was deserted, with nothing going by except black limousines. Miles above our heads." And she stared up as though at a cloud or the sun. "What's the Manhattan Bridge?" And he kept saying it was the L. "We finally found some steps and two policemen who told us to go back to the subway." "What does this amazing man do for a living?" Richard asked. "He teaches school. He's quite bright." And she stood up, stretching and extending a long, silvery white arm. Richard got her coat and said he'd walk her home. "Oh, it's only 3/4 of a block, Rebecca protested, in a voice free of any insistent inflection. "You must walk her home, Dick," Joan said. "Pick up a pack of cigarettes. The idea of his walking in the snow seemed to please her, as if she were anticipating how he would bring back with him, in the snow on his shoulders, and with the coldness of his face, all the sensations of the walk she was not well enough to risk. "You should stop smoking for a day or two," he told her. Joan waved them goodbye from the head of the stairs. The snow, invisible except around streetlights, exerted a fluttering romantic pressure on their faces. "Coming down now hard," Richard said. "Yes." At the corner where the snow gave the green light in a watery blueness, her hesitancy in following him as he turned to walk with the light across 13th Street led him to ask, "It is this side of the street you live on, isn't it?"
"Yes.
I thought I remembered from the time we drove you back from the movies." The Maples had been living in the West 80s then. "I remember I had an impression of big buildings."
"Well, the church and the butcher school," Rebecca said. "Every day about 10, when I'm going to work, the boys learning to be butchers come out for recess, all bloody and laughing."
Richard looked up at the church. The steeple was fragmentarily silhouetted against the scattered, lit windows of a tall improvement on 7th Avenue. "Poor church," he said. "It's hard in the city for a steeple to be the tallest thing." Rebecca said nothing, not even her habitual, "Yes." He felt rebuked for being preachy. In his embarrassment, he directed her attention to the first next thing he saw, a poorly lettered sign above a great door. "Food Trades Vocational High School," he read aloud. "The people upstairs told us that our apartment was part of a duplex once, and the man in it was an Englishman who called himself a purveyor of elegant produce. He kept a woman in there."
"Those big windows," Rebecca said, pointing up at an apartment house, "face mine across the street. I can look in and feel we are neighbors. Someone's always in there. I don't know what they do for a living."
After a few more steps, they halted, and Rebecca, in a voice that Richard imagined to be slightly louder than her ordinary one, said, "Do you want to come up and see where I live?"
"Sure." It seemed implausible to refuse.
They descended 4 concrete steps, opened a shabby orange door, entered an overheated half-basement lobby, and began to climb 4 flights of wooden stairs. Richard's suspicion on the street that he was trespassing beyond the public gardens of courtesy turned to certain guilt. Few experiences so savor of the illicit as mounting stairs behind a woman's fanny. 3 years ago, Joan had lived in a 4th-floor walk-up in Cambridge. Richard never took her home, even when the whole business, down to the last intimacy, had become formula, without the fear that the landlord, justifiably furious, would leap from his door and devour him as they passed. Opening her door, Rebecca said, "It's hot as hell in here," swearing for the first time in his hearing. She turned on a weak light. The room was small, slanting planes, the underside of the building's roof, intersecting the ceiling and the walls, cut large prismatic volumes from Rebecca's living space. As he moved farther forward toward Rebecca, who had not yet removed her coat, Richard perceived, on his right, an unexpected area, created where the steeply slanting roof extended itself to the floor. Here, a double bed had been placed. Tightly bounded on 3 sides, the bed had the appearance not so much of a piece of furniture as of a permanently installed, blanketed platform. He quickly took his eyes from it and, unable to face Rebecca at once, stared at 2 kitchen chairs, a metal bridge lamp, around the rim of whose shade plump fish and helm wheels alternated, and a 4-shelf bookcase, all of which, being slender and proximate to a tilting wall, had an air of threatened verticality.
Here's where the stove on top of the refrigerator I told you about, Rebecca said. Or did I?
The refrigerator was several inches narrower than its burden, and the arrangement was T-shaped. He touched the stove's white side.
"Well, this room is quite sort of nice," he said.
"Here's the view," she said.
He moved to stand beside her at the window, lifting aside the curtains and peering through tiny, flawed panes into the apartment across the street.
"That guy does have a huge window," Richard said.
She made a brief agreeing noise of "ns."
Though all the lamps were on, the apartment across the street was empty.
Looks like a furniture store, he said. Rebecca had still not taken off her coat. The snow's keeping up, he said.
Yes, it is.
Well, this word too loud. He finished the sentence too softly.
Thanks for letting me see it. I hope. Have you read this?
And he had noticed a copy of Annie Mame lying on a hassock.
I haven't had the time, she said.
I haven't read it either. Just reviews. That's all I ever read. This got him to the door. There, ridiculously, he turned. It was only at the door, he decided in retrospect, that her conduct was quite inexcusable. Not only did she stand unnecessarily close, but by shifting the weight of her body to one leg and leaning her head sideways, she lowered her height several inches, placing him in a dominating position exactly fitted to the broad, passive shadows she must have known were on her face.
Well, he said.
Well?
Her echo was immediately and possibly meaningless.
Don't let the butchers get you. The stammer, of course, ruined the joke, and her laugh, which had begun as soon as she had seen by his face that he would attempt something funny, was completed ahead of his utterance. As he went down the stairs, she rested both hands on the banister and looked down toward the next landing.
Good night, she said.
Night. And he looked up. She had gone into her room. Oh, but they were very close.
And next, a book review from the February 13th, 2006 edition of the New Yorker magazine entitled Serial Monogamy, My Cookbook Crushes by Nora Ephron. My mother gave me my first cookbook. It was 1962, and I began my life in New York with her gift of The Gourmet Cookbook, Volume 1, and several sets of sheets and pillowcases, white with scallops. The Gourmet Cookbook was enormous, a tome with a gloomy, reddish-brown binding. It had been assembled by the editors of Gourmet and was punctuated by the splendid, reverent, slightly lugubrious photographs of food that the magazine was famous for. Simply owning it had changed my mother's life. Until the book appeared in the 50s, she had been content to keep as far from the kitchen as possible. We had a wonderful Southern cook named Evelyn Hall, who cooked American classics like roast beef and fried chicken and world-class apple pie. But thanks to the Gourmet Cookbook, Evelyn began to cook chicken moringo and creme caramel. Before long, my mother herself was in the kitchen, whipping up Chinese egg rolls from scratch. A recipe for them appears on page 36 of the book, but it doesn't begin to convey how stressful and time-consuming an endeavor it is to make egg rolls. Nor does it begin to suggest how much tension a person can create in a household by serving egg rolls that take hours to make and are not nearly as good as Chinese takeout. Owning the Gourmet Cookbook made me feel wildly sophisticated. For years, I gave it to friends as a wedding present. It was an emblem of adulthood, a way of being smart and chic and college-educated where food was concerned. But I never really used it in the way you really use a cookbook, by propping it on the kitchen counter, cooking from it, staining its pages with splattered butter and chocolate splotches, conducting a unilateral dialogue with the book itself. In short, by having a relationship with it. The cookbook I used most during my first year in New York was a small volume called The Flavor of France. It was given to me by a powerful older woman I'll call Jane, whom I met that summer in the city. She was 25, and she took me in hand and introduced me not just to the cookbook, but also to Brie and Vitello Tonnato and the famous omelet place in the East 60s. In fact, the first time I went to the omelet place, which was called Madame Romain de Lyon, I was a mail girl at Newsweek, making $55 a week, and I almost fainted when I saw that an omelet cost $3.45. Jane also introduced me to the concept of one away. You were one away from someone if you had both slept with the same man. Jane had slept with a number of up-and-coming journalists, editors, and novelists, the most famous of whom, at the end of their sole night together, gave her a copy of one of his books, a box of which was conveniently situated right next to his front door. According to Jane, his exact words, as she prepared to leave, were, "Take one on your way out." The night President Kennedy was shot, Jane was having a dinner party, which went forward in spite of the tragedy, as these things tend to do. Jane served as an appetizer, celery remoulade, a dish that I had never before encountered, and that remains a mystery to me. A few months later, I had a thing with someone Jane had had a thing with, and Jane and I were now one away from one another, and, interestingly, that was the end of our friendship, though not the end of my connection to the Flavor of France. The Flavor of France was the size of a date book, just 6 by 8 inches. It contained small blocks of recipe text by Narcissa Chamberlain and her daughter, Narcisse, a large black-and-white travel photographs of France taken by Narcissa's husband and Narcisse's father, Samuel Chamberlain. I didn't focus much on the curious Chamberlain family as I cooked my way through their cookbook, and when I did, I usually hit a wall. For openers, I couldn't imagine why anyone named Narcissa would name her daughter Narcisse. Also, I couldn't figure out how they collaborated. Did the three of them drive around France together, fighting over whose turn it was to sit in the back seat? Did Narcisse like working with her parents? And if so, was she crazy? But the Chamberlain's recipes were simple and foolproof. I learned to make a perfect chocolate mousse that took about 5 minutes, and a wonderful dessert of caramelized baked pears with cream. I made those pears for years, although chocolate mousse eventually faded from my repertoire when the creme brulee years began. Just before I moved to New York, two historic events had occurred. The birth control pill was invented, and the first Julia Child cookbook was published. As a result, everyone was having sex, and when the sex was over, you cooked something. One of my girlfriends moved in with a man she was in love with. Her mother was distraught and warned that he would never marry her because she had already slept with him. "Whatever you do," my friend's mother said, "don't cook for him." But it was too late. She cooked for him. He married her anyway. This was right around the time that arugula was discovered, which was followed by endive, which was followed by radicchio, which was followed by frisée, which was followed by the three M's, mesclun, mâché, and microgreens, and that, in a nutshell, is the history of the past 40 years from the point of view of lettuce. But I'm getting ahead of my story. By the mid-60s, Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Craig Claiborne's New York Times cookbook, and Michael Field's Cooking School had become the holy trinity of cookbooks. At this point, I was working as a reporter at the Post and living in the Village. If I was home alone at night, I cooked myself an entire meal from one of these cookbooks. Then I sat down in front of the television and ate it. I felt very brave and plucky as I ate my perfect dinner. Okay, I didn't have a date, but at least I wasn't one of those lonely women who sat home with a pathetic container of yogurt. Eating a meal for four that I had cooked for myself was probably equally pathetic, but it never crossed my mind. I cooked every recipe in Michael Field's book, and at least half the recipes in the first Julia. And as I cooked, I had imaginary conversations with them both. Julia was nicer and more forgiving. She was on television by then and famous for dropping food, picking it up, and throwing it right back into the pan. Michael Field was sterner and more meticulous. He was also almost fascistic. He was full of prejudice about things like the garlic press. He believed that using one made the garlic bitter. And I threw mine away for fear that he would suddenly materialize in my kitchen and disapprove. His recipes were precise, and I followed them to the letter. I was young, and I believed that if you changed even a hair on a recipe's head, it wouldn't turn out right. When I had people to dinner, I loved to serve Michael's overcomplicated recipe for chicken curry, accompanied by condiments and papadums although I sometimes served instead a marginally simpler Craig Claiborne recipe for lamb curry that appeared in his Sunday column in the Times magazine. There were bananas in it and heavy cream. I made it recently, and it was horrible. Craig Claiborne worked at the Times not just as the chief food writer, but also as the restaurant critic. He was hugely powerful and influential, and I developed something of an obsession with him. Craig, everyone called him. Craig, even if they'd never met the man, was renowned for championing ethnic cuisine. And as his devoted acolyte, I learned to cook things like moussaka and tabbouleh. Everyone lived for his Sunday recipes. It was the first page I turned to in the Sunday Times. Everyone knew he had had a tech-built house on the bay in East Hampton, that he'd added a new kitchen to it, that he usually cooked with the French chef Pierre Frani, and that he despised iceberg lettuce. You can't really discuss the history of lettuce in the past 40 years without mentioning Craig. He played a seminal role. I have always had a weakness for iceberg lettuce with Roquefort dressing, and that's one of the things I used to have imaginary arguments with Craig about. For a long time, I hoped that Craig and I would meet and become friends. I gave a lot of thought to this eventuality, most of it concerning what I would cook if he came to my house for dinner. I was confused about whether to serve him something from one of his cookbooks or something from someone else's. Perhaps there was a protocol for such things. If so, I don't know what it was. It occurred to me that I ought to serve him something that was my recipe, but I didn't have any recipes that were truly mine, with the possible exception of my mother's barbecue sauce, which mostly consisted of Heinz ketchup. But I desperately wanted him to come over. I'd read somewhere that people were afraid to invite him to dinner. I wasn't. I just didn't know the man. I must confess that my fantasy included the hope that after he came to dinner, he would write an article about me and include my recipes. But as I say, I didn't have any. Meanwhile, I got married and entered into a series of absolutely pathological culinary episodes. I wrapped things in phyllo, I stuffed grape leaves, there were soufflés, I took a course in how to use a Cuisinart food processor, I even cooked an entire Chinese banquet that included Li Lam's lemon chicken. Li Lam was the chef at Pearl's, the famous Chinese restaurant where no one could get a table. If you did get a table, you remembered the meal forever because there was so much MSG in the food that you lay awake for years afterward. Li Lam's recipe for lemon chicken involved dipping strips of chicken breast in water chestnut flour, deep frying it, plunging it into a sauce that included canned crushed pineapple, and dousing the entire creation with a 1 ounce bottle of lemon extract. Li Lam's recipe for lemon chicken involved dipping strips of chicken breast in water chestnut flour, deep frying it, plunging it into a sauce that included canned crushed pineapple, and dousing the entire creation with a 1 ounce bottle of lemon extract. Once again, the recipe was from the Sunday Times column written by Craig Claiborne. Craig, of course, had no difficulty getting a table at Pearl's. I looked forward to going there with him someday after we had actually met and had become close personal friends. I'd gone to Pearl's once and was stunned to discover not only that it was impossible to get a table if you weren't famous, but that being famous was not enough. There were degrees of famous. There was famous enough to get a table, and then there was famous enough to get Pearl to come to the table to tell you the nightly specials, and then there was true fame, top-of-the-line fame, which was famous enough to get Pearl to allow you to order the sweet and pungent crispy fish. This was what it had come down to in New York. You had to have pull to order a fish. I became a freelance magazine writer. One of my first pieces for New York was about Craig Claiborne and Michael Field, who turned out to be at war over an unfavorable review Claiborne had written about the first of the Time Life cookbook series, which Field was in charge of. In the course of reporting the article, I met Craig Claiborne, and after the article appeared, he invited me to his house. What would he serve for dinner was What he served for dinner was not memorable, and in any case, I don't remember it. Then Claiborne came to our house for dinner, and I served a recipe from one of his cookbooks, a Chilean seafood and bread casserole that was a recipe of Leonard Bernstein's wife, Felicia Montalegre. I can't believe I can come up with her name and even how to spell it, especially given the fact that her recipe was a gluey, milky, disappointing concoction that practically bankrupted me. I don't think it was Felicia's fault that Craig and I never became friends, but there was no question in my mind after our two meals that he and I had no future together. Craig was a nice guy, don't get me wrong, but he was so low-key that once I got to know him, I was almost completely unable to even have imaginary conversations with him while cooking his recipes. Around this time, I met a man named Lee Bailey, and I guess that I would have to say that if there were any embers burning in the Craig Claiborne department, they were completely extinguished the moment I met Lee. Lee Bailey was a friend of my friend, the gossip columnist Liz Smith, who believed that everyone she knew would be friends with everyone, should be friends with everyone else she knew. So one night, she invited us to Lee's house for dinner. Lee lived in the East 40s, in a floor through below the ground, and what I distinctly remember about it was that it had some sort of straw matting on the walls that probably came from a Zuma, and it was just about the most fabulous place I'd ever seen. It was simple and easy on the eyes, and comfortable, but nothing was expensive, there was no art to speak of, and no color at all. Everything was beige. As Lee once said, be very careful about color. And then dinner was served. Pork chops, grits, collard greens, and a dish of tiny baked crab apples. It was delicious. It was so straightforward and plain and honest and at the same time so playful. Those crab apples, they were adorable. The entire evening was mortifying. A revelation, a rebuke in its way to every single thing I had ever bought and every dinner I had ever served. My couch was purple. I owned a collection of brightly painted wooden Mexican animals. I had red plates and a shag rug. My menus were overwrought, overthought, and overproduced. Would Lee Bailey ever in a million years consider cooking Lee Lum's lemon chicken? Certainly not. It was clear that my life up to that point had been a mistake. I immediately got a divorce, gave my ex-husband all the furniture, and began to make a study of Lee Bailey. I copied the theory of his menus, which always included a surprise fourth item, like those crab apples, or carrot pudding, or spoon bread. I bought the chairs he told me to buy, and the round dining room table that seemed to be part of the secret of why Lee's dinner parties were more fun than anyone else's. Lee put everything out on a buffet and let people help themselves. So did I. He didn't care if everything was piping hot. I threw away the Salton hot tray my mother had given me. When Lee opened a store at Henri Bendel, I purchased the white plates, seersucker napkins, and wood-handled stainless flatware that were just like his. I bought new furniture for my new apartment, and all of it was beige. I became Lee's love slave, culinarily speaking. Long before he began to write the series of cookbooks that made him well known, he had replaced all my previous imaginary friends in the kitchen, and whenever I cooked dinner and anything threatened to go wrong, I could hear him telling me to calm down. It didn't matter. Pour another drink. No one will care. I began to osmose from a neurotic cook with a confusing repertoire of ethnic dishes to a relaxed one specializing in faintly southern food. You might think that having Lee as a real friend might have made it superfluous to have him as an imaginary friend, but you would be wrong. As I conducted my inner conversations with Lee about what to serve or what would be the perfect fourth thing to accompany what I was serving, it never occurred to me to pick up the phone and ask him. Lee was much too easygoing. He would have just laughed and said, "Oh, anything you like, honey." He was, in his way, as close to a Zen master as I've ever had, and all of us who fell under his influence began with his style and eventually ended up with our own. I always secretly wished that Lee would include one of my recipes in one of his cookbooks. He frequently came to dinner and was always fantastically complimentary about the food. But he never asked me for any of my recipes. He did take a photograph of my backyard for one of his cookbooks, and he used my napkins and plates in the photograph. But, of course, I'd bought them at his store in Brindell's, and so it didn't really count. Meanwhile, I got married again and divorced again. I wrote a thinly disguised novel about the end of my marriage, and it contained recipes. By then, I'd come to realize that no one was ever going to put my recipes into a book, so I'd have to do it myself. I included Lee's recipe for baked lima beans and pears. Unfortunately, I left out the brown sugar, and for years people told me they'd tried cooking the recipe and it didn't work. Along with my family cook, Evelyn's recipe for cheesecake, which I'm fairly sure she got from the back of a Philadelphia cream cheese package. A food expert who wrote about the book carped that the recipes were not particularly original, but it seemed to me that she had missed the point. The point wasn't about the recipes. The point, I was starting to realize, was about making people feel at home, about finding your own style, whatever it was, and committing to it. The point was about giving up neuroses where food was concerned. The point was finding a way that food fit into your life. And after a while, I didn't have to have long internal dialogues with Lee. I'd incorporated what I'd learned from him, and I moved on. Lee never served salad or cheese, but I liked salad and cheese, so there were more dishes to wash. So what? And I got married again, by the way. In the course of my third marriage, I had a series of culinary liaisons. I went through a stretch with Marcella Hazan, a brilliant cookbook author whom I could never manage to strike up an inner dialogue with Martha Stewart, whom I worshipped and had long, long imaginary talks with, mostly having to do with my slavish adulation of her, and only recently with Nigella Lawson, whose style of cooking is very similar to mine. I gave up on her when one of her cupcake recipes failed in a big way. But I admire her willingness to use store-bought items in recipes, her lackadaisical qualities when it comes to how things look, and her fondness for home cooking. I especially like making her roast beef dinner, which is very much like my mother's, except for the Yorkshire pudding. My mother didn't serve Yorkshire pudding, although there is a recipe for it on page 61 of the Gourmet Cookbook. My mother served potato pancakes instead. I serve Yorkshire pudding and potato pancakes. Why not? You only live once. And now we'll move to the Talk of the Town section. And a piece originally published in August 23rd, 1993, entitled Home Wrecker by Susan Orlean. Recently, my friend Jean asked if I'd let a friend of his use my apartment while I was away. I declined, and then later, he mentioned that the person needing a place to stay happened to be Tina Turner. Oh, I was sorry I'd said no, because even though I don't know Tina personally, I had just seen the movie about her, What's Love Got to Do with It, and I think that it would have been cool to have her stay in my apartment. It's a two-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side, which I have decorated as if it were owned by a mid-ranking official of the Chinese Communist Party. I like how it's turned out. However, I don't know if it would be to Tina's liking. In the movie, Ike and Tina's apartment, or mansion, or whatever, has a different look from mine. But maybe Ike did their decorating. I'm a size 2, and I bet that Tina is also a 2, or maybe a 4 on her fat days. I'm sure she'd end up rummaging around in my closet, something I ordinarily wouldn't like, but I'd love to be the person who turned Tina on to J. Crew plain front relaxed fit khakis. On the other hand, if she visited on a fat day and tried something of mine on and split a seam, would she fix it? Or would she hide it and hope I'd never notice? Or, worst of all, would she throw the ruined outfit away and then let me spend the next year of my life trying to figure out where I lost my pants?
I'd hate having to worry that some celebrity who hadn't worked out her shame and denial issues was going to be destroying my stuff and then pretending it never happened. Also, does Tina Turner cook? I'll bet that she doesn't cook a lot, but that she has mastered one fancy party dish. Something that's not actually hard to make, but looks complicated, like smoked bluefish pate or nachos. It's become her signature dish whenever she goes to potlucks. People see her coming up the driveway, and instead of saying, "Hey, here comes Tina," they say, "Hey, here comes that smoked bluefish pate," or "Here come the nachos." Anyway, my kitchen is typical for New York City, so there wouldn't be much for her to see, except that I have one cupboard absolutely loaded with cans of water-packed tuna. This could have a downside. It might tempt her to just borrow a few cans, with every intention of replacing them at some future date, and we all know how often guests spend their vacation running to the grocery store to replace what they've filched. The answer is not very often. I also have these great boar bristle hairbrushes that I think a show business person with a lot of hair and an elevated hair consciousness, for example, Tina Turner, would adore. Unfortunately, I'm not crazy about sharing combs and brushes. This is something I was taught as a child. But if Tina had just shampooed and had forgotten her own stuff, she would probably use them, even if I had specifically asked her not to. No comment. I've done it myself. I think my neighbors would like Tina, but I'm not sure they'd like her clattering around the apartment in those spike-heeled pumps of hers. I would have to ask her to limit her clattering. She could borrow my socks if she wanted to, but I would appreciate their being washed afterward. Moreover, if she had friends over, and I am assuming her friends also wear noisy shoes, she'd also have to insist that they take theirs off. But they'd have to bring their own socks. If she's too uncomfortable to ask them to do something like that, then maybe she ought to get new friends. Or maybe she should look for somewhere else to stay. Isn't that what hotels are for? And next, from the September 30th, 2002 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Talk of the Town section, an essay entitled "Satchmo Was Here" by Elizabeth Colbert. For nearly half his life, Louis Armstrong lived at 3456 107th Street in Corona, Queens. When Armstrong and his fourth wife, Lucille, bought the place in 1943, it was a boxy two-story wooden house in a mostly white neighborhood. Today, it is a boxy two-story brick-faced house in an area that is mostly Hispanic. On a recent afternoon, Michael Cogswell, the director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives, was standing in front of the house discussing plans for its future. He gestured toward the attached garage, which contained a ladder, an old door, and an assortment of unidentifiable junk. "This is the visitor center," he said purposefully, if prematurely. Sometime in the next year, the Armstrong House is scheduled to open to the public as the city's newest and perhaps most intimate museum. Visitors will be invited not just to tromp through the Armstrongs' kitchen, done from floor to ceiling in turquoise, and poke around their den, paneled in wood with an early reel-to-reel tape machine, but to take in the bedroom, silver wallpaper with white lilies, and even the master bath. Armstrong, a lifelong devotee of the laxative Swiss Chris, had speakers installed in the bathroom so that he could have music piped in from the den. In addition to the Armstrong's furniture in storage while the house undergoes a $1.6 million restoration, Cogswell is hoping to fill the rooms with everyday objects like cereal boxes and perfume bottles circa 1965. "The effect we want to give is that the Armstrongs just stepped out of," he said, standing in the couple's walk-in closet, papered in what looks like crinkly aluminum foil. The idea of turning the Armstrong House into a museum has been kicking around ever since Lucille died in 1983. First, though, someone had to go through the contents of the place, a surprisingly laborious task. In addition to being the most celebrated jazz musician of his generation, Dizzy Gillespie once called him "jazz in person," Armstrong, it turns out, was a collage maker, a prolific writer, a lover of memorabilia, a home recording enthusiast, and a pack rat.
We literally have hundreds of hours of tape of Lewis and the guys sitting around the dressing room swapping dirty jokes and band stories, Cogswell said. It took Cogswell himself, a former saxophone player, 3 years to catalog the house's contents, which included 650 reels of tape, 5,000 photographs, 85 scrapbooks, 120 gold records and wards, and 5 gold-plated trumpets. Just to name the objects of significance, which are now in the Louis Armstrong archives at Queens College. Then, of course, there was the problem of money. Lucille left the house to the city of New York, intending it to be a memorial to her husband. The city clearly considered the museum a low priority, and had Cogswell and other supporters not finally succeeded in getting funds for the restoration included in the city's capital budget just a few months ago, before September 11th, chances are the project would still be on hold. Perhaps the most striking thing about the house is how unassuming it is. By the 1950s, and certainly by the 60s, the Armstrongs could have afforded to live just about anywhere in the world. They chose to remain in a not particularly spacious or even attractive house in a middle-class neighborhood, apparently because that was where Louis Armstrong felt comfortable. Lucille did once get him to go through look at a townhouse in Manhattan, but after being mobbed by autograph seekers, he got right back in his car and headed across the bridge. The modesty of the place may not seem well suited to a museum, but then again, maybe it is. As Cogswell put it, surveying the house from a tiny porch off Lewis's den, here's one of the great geniuses of Western music, not only of the 20th century, but any century, and he lived like a regular guy in Corona, Queens. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.